is your host, Hans Karl Gruprecht.
At this time of the year, poetry is in the air, as you can find out on the League of Canadian Poets webpage, poets.ca, which is showcasing an impressively long list of international poetry festivals that are currently taking place all over the world. How come? Well, as I read on poets.ca, quote, "The whole world is celebrating the possibilities of bridging cultures that poetry brings as audiences discover in poetry an antidote to lives constricted by the end of civilization." End of quote. Whether it's the end, a crisis, or the future of civilization that is at stake, poets have always become and are still fully aware of it. But of what? Maybe it's simply this. The world is too much with us later now. And to continue reading from Wordsworth's famous poem, "For this, for everything, we are out of tune." To ponder whether and what at all poets have had to say about this, I suggest reading Frederick Glacier's epic poem, The Parliament of Poets, which is in fact a truly universal epic published by Earthrise Press in 2012, and it is also available in Canada as an e-book on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, Google Play, etc. A few days ago, I spoke to him by phone. Hello, Frederick Glacier. It's great to have you on our show.
Thank you for calling. It's a pleasure to be with you and your audience.
Frederick, your book is world literature and a perspective on living world literature. Tell us more about that.
My earliest notes for the Parliament of Poets go back to 1982, so I've truly been studying and working on it for over 30 years. I'm not quite sure where the idea of writing an epic came from after all this time, but it just seemed to me that I could not find expression for what I wanted to say in lyric poetry. And so very much as a young poet, I decided I was going to write not a lot of books, but a handful, and leading me to an epic poem. So I wrote a book of lyric poems and some longer dramatic monologues in that book of lyric poems, then a book-length narrative poem, and finally stepping stones towards writing an epic poem.
Tell us how you remember July 21st, 1969. When Neil Armstrong, the first man, stepped on the moon, walked on the moon.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Like much of the world, as a young boy, I was about 15 years old at the time. I watched it on a black and white color TV as well with the millions. And it just really fired my imagination, more so than I had realized at the time, even I think now looking back. It has been said, and I agree, that the most important thing the astronauts may have obtained and brought back with them from the moon, really, was the great image of Earth from so far out over the lunar landscape. So the Parliament of Poets, my epic poem, I'm trying to evoke that, a global universal vision of life, alluding to and drawing from all the various epic strands of the world, East and West, ancient and modern. The basic plot outline, Hans, is that the Parliament of Poets takes place partly on the moon at the Apollo 11 landing site in the Sea of Tranquility. Apollo, the Greek god of poetry, called all the poets of the nation to assemble on the moon to consult on the meaning of modernity. And the Parliament of Poets then selects a poet, and then sends the poet or persona on a journey to the seven continents to learn from all of the spiritual and wisdom traditions of humankind. On Earth and on the moon, the poets teach him a new global universal vision of life.
Well, with this idea to assemble poets on the moon, you are, of course, in a world literary company. There are so many fictional authors and poets who have speculated about that kind of possibility prior to Apollo 11, man being on the moon. So you are in excellent company. Is this part of your idea to dialogue with this type of speculative literature, or is it primarily an attempt to get in conversation with the great epic literature of the world?
Well, I think that I am in dialogue, if you will, with world literature, East and West. I very much for years struggled over which poets to select, who's representative of different cultures, such as India, China, Japan, Europe, and so forth, that would be able to carry the cultures, the different regional cultures, symbolically, in a sense, too, that would speak not only to the regional civilization, if you will, but also on a global base. I do try to speak and represent who are already established world voices to one degree or another, such as Cervantes or Shakespeare and Homer and Virgil and others. But I do try to draw from a large pantheon of people from all walks of life. Of course, again, Homer and Virgil from Greek and Roman civilization, Dante, Milton, hail from Judeo-Christian West. Rumi, Attar, and Hafez step forward from Islam. Dufu and Li Po, Basho and Zayami from China and Japan, poets of the Bhagavad Gita and the Ramayana, two great epics of India. Meet on Sea of Tranquility on the moon, if you will, and along with other Indian poets, Vyasa, Kalidasa, Tagore, Griots from Africa, shamans from Indonesia and Australia, the Aborigine Japara, whose name means Moon Man, Murasaki Shikibu, Emily Dickinson, Jane Austen, the poets and seers of all ages, troubadours and minstrels. One of the major themes of my epic is the power of women and the female spirit of cross cultures I'm trying to grapple with and develop. And another is the relationship of science and religion. The two cultures of C.P. Snow, a famous British author of the late 50s, wrote a book to that title, dealing with science and the humanities, which has been a major modern problem, a difficulty of the splitting apart, if you will, of the human psyche into those two realms of science and humanity. So that's a sketch of some of the major characters.
Yes. Frederick Glacier, I should, after all, emphasize that the person who is talking to us is not necessarily identical with a character named Persona. Why did you choose Persona as your hero? Or to put it this way, it is Persona who is traveling through basically the major places through the world looking for partners, for poets with whom he or she, the persona, starts a conversation. What is the function of persona?
Well, the word itself, of course, persona, comes from the ancient Greek meaning mass, and runs throughout Western civilization as an image and idea, really. The ancient Greek actors would don a mask for their various characters, and to an extent I take that as symbolic of what writers and poets do. We put on the mask, as it's been expressed, and take on a life of character, as in Shakespeare. Shakespeare put on all those personas and they breathe life into them and make them dance across the stage, if you will. So my persona is, I would say, is not me. It is this character created, and it's often been said that Dante is not Dante. The Dante of the book is not the man, and there's that truth about epic poetry, that this is a creation of a universal symbolic character carries an import and meaning that's very hard to define, but it's really Apollo who calls the parliament of poets on the moon and chooses to, through Cervante, to bring this character, this universal poet, in a sense, to the moon to be instructed by all the great poets of the various civilizations in a new vision of life through a journey, a archetypal, if you will, almost Jungian journey through the cosmos and back to Earth, repeatedly.
Could one say, using Georges Dumézil's distinction between the three major functions in so far as they characterize Indo-European societies and epics, that persona is a priest-like figure and not the warrior and not a commoner, right?
Well, I think it's probably fair to say about my character, you know, it's often said about epic poetry throughout the ages, who and what is the hero and how is that hero characterized says much about the values of the day and the time and also the vision of the epic poet. What is the ideal? And I do think I know I've worked and I've struggled with that as well within modern terms. What can I find meaning in and suggest?
All right. Now, persona travels, right? And he or she travels in company of other poets. Where does it start and where does it end?
All right. Well, basically, from Homer and from the Roman poet Virgil, there is the great structural device called in medias re in Latin, meaning in the midst of things. And that is one element of the epic form that I struggled with for many, many years, trying to figure out how to make that work in a modern time. And I hope I've achieved it for others to judge. But,
well, I would say, yes, you did. I love your book.
Right. Well,
that's wonderful.
Thank you. I take encouragement for that. I'm going to speak that for the reader, Hans.
Yeah, of course.
So basically, it begins in the middle of things, meaning it begins on the moon. The persona is already on the moon. And various things take place for a couple of books or so, and then there's a flashback that explains how he got up to the moon to begin with. And that kind of flashback device we take for granted in modern movies and theater and so forth, but that really comes out of the epic poetry tradition to have flashbacks that fill in previous events kind of thing. So the epic begins with that kind of flashback, and then the parliament on the moon, they start selecting places around the world to send the persona or the poet to and generating him along to various places. Namely, the American Indian Black Elk, early in that second book, takes the persona to the cave of Lascaux in France, instructs him in the meaning of that age of human civilization and development, roughly dated around 19,000 BC or so. And another point, the persona visits Lambo's Cave, a very recent discovery of a very ancient cave in South Africa that goes back even farther in time, where Homo sapiens lived as long as 70,000 years ago. They're finding artifacts 100,000 years ago in that cave. That's one episode, if you will. And then all the other major continents are visited and evoked in his travel back and forth to the moon. Angkor Wat in Cambodia, the Buddhist Mogao Caves on the Old Silk Road in China, Chartres Cathedral in France, of course, ancient Israel, Africa, South America, elsewhere, with a visit in England and Poldoy in Russia.
Frederick, I would like to hear the poet now. And it is in book three that we, as the readers, are being addressed. Maybe that's the moment where you would like to read a passage from book three, which I find indicative of that what you wish to tell us, your readers.
All right, my pleasure. Book three, near the end of In Medias Re part I was just describing as a flashback, beginning of that book, the persona speaking.
Oh, reader, how can I tell you about the voyage to the moon? How convey the glories that I saw there above the earthly realm? There the sun always shines, its glowing rays intensely light the way, so brilliantly that all the stars are overwhelmed. all lesser lights give way as in obeisance, and one sees but the blackest black of space, not threatening and fearful, serene as God in high bliss contemplating his own nature, the marble earth floating through creation. And so Shapara and I approach the moon, scar-faced man to the scar-faced man in the moon, the sea of tranquility, from still far above the surface growing closer, like a lunar module seeking its landing site, the box surface of the moon ever nearer, craters with white rays spewing out for miles. Beyond ground control, on manual now, we zeroed in. And I could see from above a great throng assembled, even larger than when I had left with Black Elk for the regions below the earth itself. Now back to the supernal realm I came, Shapara my guide and protector from the scars of life and precarious woe. Masters far beyond numbering were there, poets and seers, bards and balladeers, Italian sonneteers, Greek pastoralists, the singers of Middle Eastern gazelles, the storytellers of all ages, generations, answering the call to parley on the moon for all mankind.
Thank you very much, Frederick. I think there is, after all, a purpose for the itinerary, for having written this book, but it's not a way of saying we must do this, we need that, because there are passages, and maybe a little bit long, our itinerary, you would like to read this passage, where a poet questions the idea of having a congress of poets. Why are you hesitant to say this is something we need in our world?
Well, you're referring to Book 10 with the Argentinian poet Borges.
Yes.
Borges actually wrote a short story, one of dealing with characters who wanted to create a Congress of the World, sort of a United Nations, if you will.
That's right.
Sort of a utopian kind of community or whatever. And much of the emphasis of that story is kind of the background of...
Please read us now from Book 10, a passage which involves Jorge Luis Borges.
Borges looked uneasy, agitated, shifted his stance, saying, "Consequently, we shouldn't stay here too long to be safe. We better think about moving on soon. The Congress is a nice idea, truly should exist someday, though secretly now that institution of the universe, ourselves. That is to say, one always has to be on the lookout for swords and daggers, knife fighters." Understanding the connection, I admitted, "I'm only a gringo from El Norte, though like you, one with English roots, a practical sensibility, if there ever was one in this world of El Toboso." "Oh, Borges, a tale out of your own stories. We enjoyed a good laugh together, two hidalgos standing on the pampas." The moon was now high in the east. "On the endless plain north of Buenos Aires," Borges said, "we must look up, elevate our view, gaze far away from our small self. For all our travels to and from the moon, we're not even able to draw near its essence. High in the heavens, the moon remains. Though astronauts went there, they didn't get it. So the moon hangs in our dreams, our reflections on who we are and what it all means, reflections on this vain and dubious world, wracked by one violent junta after another, juntas of the serving creatures tearing apart the flesh of others for their own sustenance, knife fighters on the pampas of the soul.
If Argentina exists, it finds unity in the rich stew of humanity simmering together. Savor it. So the Congress of the World always exists. We don't need to and can't create it.
You put Jorge Luis Borges in a very privileged position insofar as he is the writer who opens the Americas to the persona, to us. Why did you choose Borges?
Well, you know, there are 12 chapters or books, as they're referred to in the epic tradition. And the 12 chapters, by the time I really spent over 4.5 years writing it, and so it was a very long struggle to get to book 9, if you will. And the actual plot, as I had initially conceived of it, I had no intention to, well, I ended in India a second time, but it just didn't feel right, and I didn't know where to go from there, and I spent really a whole summer reading and struggling with my soul that it was just not done with book 9. And it was Borges' affinity for the poet Walt Whitman and his own writing and poems on Japan. For instance, Borges actually visited Japan at one time where I lived for a year and a half, fairly young 20s. And so anyway, all that kind of came together, and having read Borges decades ago, memories of various things came together, and he kind of opened the door into South America for me through Whitman and his associations with a poet from Chile, Pablo Neruda, and Octavio Paz from Mexico. They all came together. It was really Borges that enabled me to find a way to write about South America, which was very important for me to do, I feel, and round the book out. And from there, I was able to go on to Africa and back to the world.
Frederick, I thank you very much for this conversation.
Sure, thank you.